You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 428, our 54th Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you feeling?
Well, you know, so-so, but we'll, yeah. You know, like I said, we'll get through it. Not every day can be as good as other days, so.
Yeah. Well, we certainly appreciate you taking your time out to answer our questions, because I know
you're doing
other things.
Yep, the podcast is at least something I can look forward to.
All right, well, good deal. It's a good excuse then, I guess.
Yep.
For me too. I enjoy it, so I look forward to it. All right, Mike. Well, why don't we just jump in here with Nathan. And Nathan was trying to see if you had any information on Joshua 10, when Joshua prays that God would stop the sun. There seems to be lots of debate on this, and I have come across John Walton's view that it may be related to ancient Near Eastern astrological omen text. I'm not a scholar and cannot seem to find enough resources to determine if this view is accurate in the ancient Near Eastern context, or if it's just speculative. Have you heard of this idea, and can you shed some light on it?
Yeah, I've heard of it. It is speculative, but other things that could be said about it would be speculative as well, about other interpretations. So it's certainly possible this could be related to some sort of omen language. For those who are interested in, Walton does have an article entitled Joshua 10, 12 through 15 and Mesopotamian Celestial Omen Texts. And it's in the book titled Faith, Tradition, and History, Old Testament Historiography in its Ancient Near Eastern Context. And that's edited by Millard, Hoffmeyer, and Baker. So if you had that resource, you could go look up the article. This is one option, again, that maybe there's some kind of omen that Joshua is praying for, that, you know, the Lord would do something, and whether that means it's an eclipse or, you know, some other celestial phenomenon, you know, we have to speculate. So that's the speculative part of it. There are texts of this nature where some military context will be calling for a celestial omen, you know, to favor or, you know, go against the enemy and stuff like this. So there's certainly a parallel context for it, but there's probably not enough in Joshua itself to make that correlation secure. But it can certainly be argued for us. It's a possibility. Another possibility is to argue that it's not necessarily an omen text or anything like this, but it is a prayer against the, you know, foreign gods, the gods of Canaan. And this is usually defended on the basis of Habakkuk chapter 3. So in Habakkuk 3, we read, I'll start in verse 3. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Now, this is a key verse here. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. So the word pestilence in that verse, this is verse 5, is dever. And the word translated plague that follows it is reshef. Dever and reshef are also names of ancient Canaanite deities. So you could have this idea here of these other deities following at the heels of Yahweh, you know, like whimpering puppies or whatever. Verse 6 says, He, Yahweh, stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the heavens. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers? Or your indignation against the sea? When you rode on your horses and your chariot of salvation. Let me just stop there. This is verse 8. Rivers is Nahar, and sea is the word Yam. Both of these are also Canaanite deities. Verse 9. You stripped the sheath from your bow. calling for many arrows, you split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed, and raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice and lifted its hands on high. And here's verse 11. The sun and moon stood still in their place. At the light of your arrows, they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. We'll just stop there. So there's this reference to the sun and moon standing in their place amidst this other part of this poem in Habakkuk 3 that have the gods of Canaan in subservient roles, lesser roles, the lesser status than the God of Israel, than Yahweh. The whole point of this teaching is that forces of plague and pestilence and whatever else these gods are supposed to be ruling over, they don't actually have these powers. These powers belong to Yahweh. So these gods are shown to be in submission to Yahweh in this passage. And there are other passages like this too in the Old Testament, where some other foreign god is cast in a subservient light. I think that's the best way to put it. So if this is true with these other deity names, plague, pestilence, rivers, sea, you know, Yam, Nahar, Dever, you know, Reshef. If it's true here, if this is how to read the text here, that this is essentially a statement of spiritual superiority, then maybe when in verse 11 in Habakkuk he gets to the sun and the moon standing place, maybe that's to mark out Shemesh or Shapesh, deity name, also the word for the sun, and Yareach or Yarich, also a deity name. So maybe what Joshua is praying for in Joshua chapter 10 is for God to have victory over the other gods of Canaan and not literally stop the sun and the moon. So again, this is how the viewpoint is argued on the basis of Habakkuk 3, this parallel text. It seems pretty clearly parallel. Sun and moon, you know, right there. This is how this viewpoint is typically argued for. As opposed to something astronomical. But, you know, Walton's other idea of celestial omens, just, you know, more broadly, could also be in view too. But again, these are speculations, and you'd have to judge which ones are more textually rooted than others. You know, God can certainly do what he wants in the physical world. But is that the right way to read Joshua 10? You know, again, there's disagreement there, as the questioner noted.
Rose in Minnesota has a question about the prosperity and faith teachings. What are your thoughts on the idea that we only need faith that God will heal us to get healing, or that he will provide for all our needs, that he will give us prosperity as we have faith in him?
Yeah, I don't think very much of it. As far as them wanting, you know, as far as you might want to know, what do they do with passages like 1 Timothy 5:23, where Paul can't heal Timothy. He knows Timothy has a problem with his stomach. He tells him to take some wine for his stomach's sake. Paul couldn't heal himself, you know, from the thorn in the flesh. He has to ask three times, and of course the answer was no on each of those cases. You know, if we were all automatically healed by the work on the cross, then these passages shouldn't even come up. You know, Paul should never have been afflicted, you know, with a thorn in the flesh. Timothy should never have gotten sick. Nobody should ever get sick. You know, no Christian, because we're already healed. Well, again, I think that's nonsense. I think it's really over-reading the passage. You know, the healing in passages like Isaiah, by his stripes we are healed, is metaphorical and spiritual. You know, there's no rule against using words like healing to speak metaphorically or figuratively. And that's what's going on here. Again, when Jesus runs into people who are, you know, are sick, you know, not only doesn't he heal them all, but he never accuses them of doing something wrong. You know, as to why they're sick. There may be one or two cases where you know what he says to them, you might wonder, but he heals people. He doesn't blame them, you know, for their situation, or he doesn't promise that once I die, everybody's going to get healed. Nothing of the sort. So I think it's really, dramatically overreading the text. If you think about it in real life, then this means that no Christian should ever be able to break a bone. No Christian should ever, you know, suffer the loss of an eye or a limb or a single, you know, digit on the finger. That doesn't make any sense. That's like if I accidentally saw off my finger, it's going to grow back because I'm a Christian. By his stripes, I'm healed. You know, again, I think very little of Word of Faith and these kinds of teachings, because they're demonstrably unscriptural, and they're, you know, in some cases they're just downright wacky. They're demonstrably untrue by real life. So beyond that, you know, again, I'd probably get a little meaner. I don't want to get mean here, but again, I think this is very misleading and harms people.
Gary asks, do demons or spiritual beings have the power to put thoughts into believers' minds?
Yeah, we don't have much to go on here. This is actually somewhat discussed in my demons book. I have a little in the Q&A in the demons book. There's a question there about, can demons read minds? And that question, I'll just go read what I put there, because it'll segue into this. The question about whether demons can read minds usually arises from presumptions we have about consciousness, relationship to beings. The fact that angels appear to 1:20. Matthew 2:13 and 19, Acts 10, verse 3, seems to suggest that supernatural beings can tap into one's mind. The assumption is that since evil spirits are fallen angels, then Satan and demons have the ability to occupy space in the human mind. That angels in the New Testament instructed people through such means is not evidence of mind reading, though. So I don't think they can read minds. But if anything, such incidents describe the transmission of information, not reading minds. Such incidents could, of course, influence human behavior and might conceivably be a line of demonic oppression. So, you know, I think, is it possible for Satan or a demon to put something into somebody's mind? I think the answer to that is yes. You know, dreams would be a peripheral way of illustrating that. But having said that, having at least allowed it for angels, there is no scriptural example of Satan or an evil spirit appearing to somebody in a dream. Okay, as such, it's impossible to make a scriptural statement for some sort of demonic influence over the mind. Again, this is all you've got, which isn't much. You know, that angels can influence people through their mental states, including sleep. But does that mean that Satan and demons do that? Are they allowed to do that by God? We don't have any indication that God does allow it. We know that for the other side, the angels, this is possible. So maybe it's possible for them, you know, to influence people this way, or maybe this is part of possession or oppression or something like that. But we're just not told, so we have very little to go on here.
Leroy watched a video that Dr. Heiser did concerning the post-Christian future. In that video, he eloquently showed, using biblical texts, how the Apostle Paul called the gospel a mystery because it was hidden from them. My question is, does Isaiah 9 verse 6 describe Jesus, and also Isaiah 52 with emphasis on verse 14?
Yeah, I think it does. I think both those verses do describe the suffering Messiah, who is Jesus, and the reigning Messiah, who is Jesus. That would be Isaiah 9, 6. I don't think there's much of a relationship between them. But, yeah, I do think that this is the case for both of them. So I'm not sure that seems to be the only question that was asked here. So I'll just leave it at that.
Adam has our last question. In Colossians 1, verse 20, Paul says God was pleased through him, Jesus, to reconcile everything to himself, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. We know that humanity has been offered reconciliation on earth, but what things in heaven is he talking about reconciling?
Yeah, this is actually in the angels' book. This is why the books are written, so that you know, we can cover questions like this at length, but let me just pull a few things out for the sake of this episode. Most scholars would acknowledge that all things, whether on earth or in heaven, in Colossians, in this verse, in verse 20, includes the heavenly host. Okay, this is usually where this comes up in the question. So in light of that assumption, the issue that requires consideration is the meaning of reconcile and making peace through the cross. Most readers presume that this language refers to the forgiveness of sins, but that is not necessarily the case, and really not the case here. This comes up when I get the question, can fallen angels be redeemed? The answer to that is no, according to Hebrews 2. And I don't think that's contradicted by Colossians 1:20. You have to read in the idea of forgiveness of sins to reconciliation, which in some contexts may be in view, in other contexts is not in view. The idea of reconciliation is multifaceted. For example, the work of Christ here in Colossians 1 is connected to the renewal of creation, you know, and in other passages. That has nothing to do with forgiveness of sins. The creation didn't sin. Okay, the planet didn't sin. So the reconciliation talked about there has nothing to do with forgiveness of sins. So that's just a way of pointing out that the terminology itself has no inherent relationship to the forgiveness of sins, or, you know, healing some moral offense or you know, whatever. If you take a look at the verse in Greek, again, I'm trying to skip around through what I have in the book here. The book does this much better than I'm doing it here. In Colossians 1:20, you have through him to reconcile, and the verb form is aorist. To himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace. And there you have another aorist participle, in this case, by the blood of his cross. Aorist tenses for verbal forms in Greek, we have an infinitive here and a participle in this verse. Those grammatically have to do with completed time or past time, not to time in progress or a time yet unfulfilled. It has nothing to do with the future. So really, the verse is saying that through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, having made peace. I mean, this is already a reality by the blood of his cross. What you're going to find out is this reconciliation talk, again, if you read what I have in the book here, is part of the already but not yet. This is already true, but not yet. And it has to do with wider creation. I will read one quotation from one scholar here. It says, the Greek eis auton to him here does not indicate the completion of imminent reconciliation and thus does not indicate a futuristic occurrence. The expression which is construed in the aorist tense, all things are reconciled with him, is to be interpreted as a parallel construction to the expression in stanza one, that's Colossians 1:16. All things were created in him, you know, were created in him. It's past tense idea. Let's see here. Accordingly, reconciliation has its foundation in the creation and is now arriving at its completion in the dominion of the Son over all things. The point is that the statements in Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, must be understood in tandem with Colossians 1:20, through him to reconcile himself all things, whether on heaven or on earth. Both statements are in the same paragraph unit, and both, you know, the verbs are in aorist tense, the Greek tense which focuses on completed action, not action in process, or action yet unaccomplished. Therefore, the reconciliation of Colossians 1:20, which we haven't defined yet, is rooted in creation, and now, after the cross, is moving toward its consummation, which is itself expressed as the dominion of the Son over all things. So, you know, again, I discuss this at length in the book, but basically what's in view in Colossians 1:20 is a cosmic reset back to the original creation of all things, both in heaven and on earth. In other words, when the new earth is consummated, when everything is, you know, said and done, and you know, the future heaven, okay, heaven on earth, the new earth is here and has been realized, that state, again, is going to be just like, you know, Eden was, both in terms of the physical earth and also in terms of things invisible, which would include the heavenly host. There's going to be no rebellion. Okay, there's going to be no, you know, no sin, no rebellion. It's going to, again, be restored to a pristine Edenic state. And that's what the reconciliation is about. It's not about the forgiveness of either angel's sins or the earth's sins. And one is denied by Hebrews 2, and the other one makes no sense because the earth is an inanimate object. Again, so that's really what it's referring to when you get to the things invisible. It's the heavenly host, but the idea is that the heavenly host is restored to what it originally was before there was any rebellion. So it's not talking about restoration or forgiveness, because again, that's specifically denied in Hebrews 2. Jesus became a man to effect the plan of salvation. He didn't become an angel. The incarnation is linked specifically and intrinsically to the plan of redemption. The incarnation, it's for humans, you know, not for non-humans. It's for his human imagers, not the other ones. But anyway, the point is that reconciling all things, whether in heaven or on earth, in Colossians 1:20, refers to the restoration of creation order and authority, just generally.
All right, Adam, you can go buy the book. That's our official answer. So everybody else that wants to know about angels being forgiven and stuff, go buy the book. Right, Mike? It's been a hot topic.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, we appreciate everybody sending in those questions. Again, keep sending me those questions at tracestrickland@gmail.com. Mike, we appreciate you answering our questions. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.